Finally, we return to Dr. Petrylak, who wanted to elaborate more on where he sees systemic therapy of prostate cancer heading in the future, and to make the point, he presented a fascinating and perhaps controversial case from his own practice.
He's a 46-year-old male who about 4 years ago had a radical prostatectomy and had lymph node positive disease, Gleason's 9, and underwent hormone therapy, maximal androgen blockade after his surgery. He's lymph node positive, so I went according to the messing data.
How was he diagnosed?
He had a screening PSA done and had a biopsy, and it was Gleason's 9, and a prostatectomy was Gleason's 9. So about 8 or 9 months ago, he started having a rising PSA. We withdrew his Casodex and then started him on Nizoral and cortisone. He had a short response to Nizoral and cortisone, which lasted the average of about 4 or 5 months. And now his PSA is rising. In fact, it rapidly rose from about 6 or 7 to 50 in about a 4-week period, and then to 70 about 2 weeks later.
Can you talk a little bit more about him as a person?
He works in an office. He was married, I think, about a year or two before his prostatectomy. And his wife was actually pregnant with their first child when he underwent his prostatectomy. He's actually a very decent individual. I like him a lot. He's a good fellow.
Can you talk about the discussion that went on about whether or not to do that and why in this man you both came to that decision?
In his situation, it was pretty clear. It was supported by the messing study, where hormone therapy early was better than delayed hormone therapy and came at the cost of losing his sexual function, but he wanted to live and he wanted to see his son grow up. I think that the choice was pretty clear.
What went into the discussion about using MAB in him as opposed to just an LHRH agonist?
Since the messing study used MAB, that's what we were consistent with.
How did he tolerate the androgen deprivation?
Actually, very well. Minimal hot flashes, maybe put 5 pounds on over the last couple of years, but fairly well.
Why is it that you feel convinced that combined blockade is sort of state-of-the-art, and yet generally that's not what's utilized by the majority, certainly of urologists?
I think that when you look at the meta-analysis, there is a small but detectable difference in survival in favor of combined blockade. And although it's about 4%, it's small, but nonetheless, there have been other therapeutic interventions that have been done for similar benefit, and I think it's appropriate to give it.
And then he got into the situation where it sounds like you felt he was hormone refractory, but he still had PSA-only disease.
Right. He had these small sub-centimeter lymph nodes on CT scan, which were, according to the scan, and when I reviewed it, more numerous, but they were still very, very small, and no evidence of disease on bone scan. So based upon this rapid PSA doubling, I was not comfortable with just waiting and watching until he developed metastatic disease.
So what did you do?
We started him on Taxotere.
As a single agent?
Single agent.
What was the dose and schedule?
75 per meter squared.
That was every 3 weeks?
Every 3 weeks, yes.
What happened?
He just finished his second course, so it's a little early to tell yet.
How is he tolerating the therapy?
So far, very well.
What are your general thoughts about the use of chemotherapy in PSA-only disease?
Well, I think that we need to be selective. Again, we don't have trials to determine when's the best time to use chemotherapy. This decision to go forth with chemotherapy was a decision that was made between this patient, his wife, and myself. We had a good half an hour discussion about the pros and cons. The interesting study that's come out over the last several years is the Matt Smith study, where he looked at PSA doubling times and absolute PSA values in relationship to the development of bone metastases in asymptomatic PSA rising patients. And only about a third of those patients in the time frame that he analyzed them developed metastatic disease. And the most important prognostic factors towards the development of metastatic disease were a PSA doubling time of less than 6.3 months and absolute PSA value of greater than 24. But again, we don't know if those are the patients who would benefit from early therapy or not.
Do we know anything about what the impact is of chemotherapy or docetaxel specifically in PSA-only disease?
We don't really know. I mean, we know that we'll see PSA declines. That much we do know. But whether we can delay the time to the development of bone metastases is unclear at this point. We don't know whether chemotherapy will delay the time to bone progression in patients who do not have bone metastases and are asymptomatic. We don't have any data.
Any reason to think that chemotherapy or docetaxel specifically would sort of artifactually lower the PSA without really affecting the disease?
I think that there have been cell line studies that have looked at that issue. We know that the LNCAP prostate cancer cell line will secrete PSA, and if you expose these cells to various agents, you can see what the effect on PSA modulation is. And generally, taxanes do not increase PSA or decrease PSA levels solely.
I'm curious what you say to your patients and what you said, for example, to this man specifically in terms of what to expect in terms of side effects and toxicity from docetaxel.
The side effects that we describe are neutropenia, neutropenic fevers, numbness in the fingers and toes, edema, lacrimation, and fatigue. Those are the major ones.
What's your take on what we know right now about the anti-tumor effect of intermittent therapy?
I think theoretically it has good grounding. There was some good preclinical work that looked at this in the Chagoni tumor model system as well as in the LNCAP. I think we just have to wait to see what the clinical data is. The problem with intermittent therapy is that there have been so many different ways in which individuals have tried to go forth with it. The number of cycles of hormone therapy, when to reinitiate patients, the PSA threshold values. If the SWOG study, which compares intermittent to continuous blockade, is a negative trial or doesn't show a major difference, then I think we may have some trouble interpreting some of the other studies. I think it's going to be interesting to see the results of the SWOG intermittent therapy study. Certainly, if intermittent therapy is inferior to combined blockade given continuously, there'll be a lot of questions raised as to whether the treatment arm or the experimental arm used in the SWOG study is as good as some of the other types of intermittent therapy out there in the community. And I think that we're all awaiting the results of that trial because it really will make a major impact on patient care.
So is that a strategy that you utilize in your practice off protocol?
I utilize it off protocol. I tell patients up front that I still believe that the standard of care is combined blockade given continuously. However, if for whatever reason you can't tolerate the treatment, it's acceptable to give it intermittently.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and to our community-based urologist panel. And thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Prostate Cancer Update.